ladies and gentlemen, and honored members of the society, excuse me, family and friends, it is so difficult for me to describe how truly privileged I feel to be addressing you today, especially that this is the penultimate moment of my career, and how enormous the appreciation I feel for all of those here and some no longer here, but dearly remembered who helped me grow professionally from surgical adolescence to maturity. And what a debt I owe to my mentors, amongst them Richard Engdahl and John Mannick, Lester Williams, Herb Heckman, Peter Deckers, and Joe Savetta, and to the giants of American surgery who have preceded us and who continue to inspire. And how warmly and rich my life has been by my two sons, Josh and Jonathan, whose character and accomplishments inspire me every day of my life. And my brother Maury, who entertained us so beautifully last night and who has been my constant counsel and confidant. They are my family. But then again, so are all of you, my friends and my colleagues. As Giles suggested, this has been a most circuitous journey for me, and an incredible journey it has been. One that continues to teach and astonish me. And I hope in sharing a look back at it today, those of you well along yours will recognize something of your own miraculous paths, and those younger of you who today anticipate your future may find something that you might find useful along the way. And to shape this talk, I'm reminded of the advice that the King of Hearts gives to Alice in Wonderland just before she has to testify at the trial of the Mad Hatter. He counseled, begin at the beginning. Go until you come to the end. And then stop. So there I was, a brand spanking new third-year medical student. Blue button-down Oxford shirt, regimental striped tie, white coat, white pants, Baswegian loafers, Stedman stethoscope, and Washington manual in my pocket, day one of my internal medicine clerkship on the female service of Cook County Hospital. Now let's let our minds drift back to that time. Recall that in that time, the third-year medical student functioned as the intern as the resident, and the chief resident as the attending. With the real attending, well, let's say that he, and it was mostly he rather than she in those days, was available mainly by phone. So while making rounds that first day, I came across a lovely, lovely lady who was lying calmly in the supine position in four-point leather restraints. And after a brief conversation, I determined that she was perfectly lucid and oriented to at least one of the responses to time, place, and person, and given the extreme wealth of my vast prior experience in cases such as these, I determined that this was unacceptable. So, I marched up to the nursing station and requested, I actually think I declared, I demanded, that she be released from this inhumane bondage. A request which stupefyingly to me, the nurse had the temerity to refuse. It was then that I uttered for the first time and the last time those four fateful words that flowed so freely from my lips. I'm the doctor. Now, in retrospect, I cannot imagine how that nurse contrived her look of absolute disdain with utterly clairvoyant amusement as she dismissively handed me the keys to the restraints and growled, okay, doctor, you do it. What followed, I understand, is still chronicled as legend in the house officer's manual of Cook County Hospital under, quote, holes available to dig yourself into. For once out of her bonds, in a spectacular move worthy of only Muhammad Ali, my apparently oriented patient leaped up, simultaneously grabbing her purse and swung it in a perfect parabola, flooring me with a right cross to the head before sprinting like a gazelle out the front door of Cook Suffolk County Hospital onto Harrison Avenue. And how vividly, and when I finally got to my feet, how vividly I remembered that outstretched arm ending in the pointed finger and the voice of the nurse bellowing, "You, it's you, mister, I'm the doctor, go get her." Suffice it to say that chasing a screaming woman who was dressed in an untied Johnny, sans lingerie, two blocks down one of Chicago's busiest streets was not exactly something that I anticipated doing on day one of what I hoped would be an illustrious medical career. And not surprisingly, I am the doctor, never passed these lips again. That is, until today. Because you see, I had absolutely no idea what I'm the doctor meant. I had to learn, in fact, that it was a quintessential description of who I wasn't. I actually thought then that being able to trace a drop of blood through any tributary in the circulatory system, or defining the then current physiologic principles, or diagramming the major biochemical pathways learned in the first 2 years of medical school confirmed upon me and my colleagues all of the rights and responsibilities of medicine. Accompanied, of course, by my acute and astute observation of the modern practice of medicine by the likes of Marcus Welby and Ben Casey and Richard Kildare, I had acquired all of the essential prerequisites for my professional debut. How naive and how predictable that I would spend an entire career learning the truth of what that phrase truly meant. For in part, it means that just as musical performers must not simply learn to play the violin or the oboe or the harp, they must learn to play music on the violin and the oboe and the harp. So too, the doctor does not treat illness. The doctor treats people who are ill. And that's not merely a science or a technique. That's a privilege. And I could not have learned that from medical school or books or teachers. I had to learn that from the only people who could ever teach it to me. I had to learn that from my patients. And how different a world it was then when my true education first began. Fortunately, for me and my patients in that era, there really wasn't much that I could do wrong. Some still employed rotating tourniquets, phlebotomy, and mercurohydrin diuretic for the treatment of acute pulmonary edema. In fact, ethocrinic acid was only first introduced for the treatment of congestive heart failure in 1968. All antibiotics were first generation and were easily correlated with red bugs or blue bugs seen under the ward microscope. We had aramine for hypotension and Alzomet for hypertension, and cardiac function was measured indirectly via an intravenous injection of decalin solution into the antecubital vein and the time that it took for the patient to have an unpleasant taste in the back of their tongue. So back then, my context, my understanding of medicine was defined primarily by the task-oriented aspects of patient care. I performed endless histories and physicals, became an aniline dye stain aficionado, confirmed by fingers virtually permanently tattooed red and blue. I was certified in phlebotomy and transportation logistics, and of course, retractor extraordinaire. In fact, I was defined by my industry, and in retrospect, although I can remember the hours of care that I delivered and my being consumed by the completion of tasks, I'm embarrassed to say today that I did not recall having the focus for the caring for or about my patients. I'm sure that I did, but I can only recall having too much stuff to do. How ironic, that same morning that I made my historic first impression, I met Robert Horner, whose wisdom, integrity, and curiosity and passion for medicine had such a profound influence on my professional life. Recall that in 1968, biomedical diagnostic technology was essentially limited to plain x-ray and fluoroscopy. Most laboratory tests were conducted by the clinical team. That was me. Blood gas analysis required pre-approval, and a tribunal decided who would or who would not be dialyzed, and there were few recognizable intensive care units. So in contrast to today's vast technical agnostic armamentarium. The cutting-edge diagnostic tools available then were, in fact, the senses you were born with, that hopefully over time would become so fine-tuned and honed that a definitive diagnosis required only a confirmatory test. Bob Harder taught me the art and science of physical diagnosis, an art that I fear is viewed by so many in training today as so primitive and so rudimentary and so supplanted by modern technology that it has the potential to functionally disappear altogether. As chief resident, Bob was the medical consultant for the entire medical and surgical population of this 1,500-bed hospital, a responsibility that would require his attention away from our ward for most of the day and night. However, each morning after rounds, he insisted that we visit all of those patients that he had seen the day before, so that he could share with me the physical signs and symptoms, the recognition of which was so essential, in his opinion, to becoming the consummate physician. The challenge was, can you make the diagnosis using your senses? I learned that blunted lateral eyebrows and a deep, hoarse voice were consistent with hypothyroidism, and that a curious and persistent smile and difficulty in swallowing were pathognomonic for tetanus, and that a succussion splash heard with the stethoscope over the left upper quadrant demanded gastric decompression in the diabetic to prevent massive aspiration, that the lack of liver dullness and hollow viscous perforation were intimately correlated, and that whispering pectoriloquy and egophony predicted pulmonary consolidation. And when I stood at the foot of the bed of a patient whose head was rhythmically bobbing up and down and predicted that the auscultation of the heart would confirm aortic insufficiency, you would think that he had just won the Nobel Prize for education. We would look for histiocytes for the first three drops of blood in the earlobe to rule in SBE and check a standing urine for porphyria. We timed the first heart sound and committed to a split S1 or S4 and described complex murmurs all later to be described by us with a, quote, borrowed phonocardiogram. Bob taught me that the attention to the principles of inspection and palpation and percussion and auscultation were the foundation of a structurally sound and solid physician, and made me promise that even though I was to become a surgeon, I would never erode that foundation through neglect. But there was something else that I learned from this very special healer. I learned that the use of all of those senses required that I be connected to the individual whose privilege it was mine to serve. I learned that you can't listen to the chest with an X-ray, nor can you palpate the abdomen with a CAT scan. You can only do that by being physically connected to the patient. You have to touch. It is precisely that intimacy that has been replaced by modern technological diagnostic distance, albeit more accurate and sophisticated. But at what cost? At what cost? I'll forever be grateful to Bob for helping to lay a most solid foundation so early in my career, but more to the point, that I'm the doctor began to acquire definition. What followed for me during my surgical residency in the 70s was nothing short of nirvana. And although I am tempted to wax endlessly on this golden age of surgical education led by the giants of American surgery, I will simply say that despite the rigor of the schedule and profound personal sacrifices, without question would I do it again. Now, here too, one success, at least my success, was measured by industry and efficiency, and diagnostic accuracy, technical skill, clinical care, with precious little time for the emotional investment for caring. Once again, completing the task so endlessly listed in the script book, along with the many hours on round and in the operating room, trumped my search for the human connection. But happily, and finally upon becoming attending surgeon, I began to see that the doctor-patient relationship in practice was comprehensive, longitudinal, buck-stopping, and filled with the opportunity to get to know in the greatest detail not only the clinical aspects of the patient's lives, but also the essence of the patients themselves. And Nellie Smith taught me this. She was one of the kindest individuals I ever cared for, and one of those very special patients with whom you make an instant connection and never, ever forget. Sadly, there came the day that I had to tell her that her disease was winning. I did so, typically for me at the time, standing at the foot of the bed, both geographically and emotionally keeping my distance. But as I started to speak, I'm sure awkwardly, given my relative inexperience in presenting bad news at the time, Nellie, sensing my anxiety, simply patted the bed by her side, motioning to me to come sit next to her. And I did. And she took my hand and smiled and said, "Dr. Yeskin, I'm all better now." That was a defining moment for me so early in my career. Never again would I stand at the foot of the bed. Never again to distance myself emotionally from those whom I've been so privileged to serve. That overwhelming, unexpected transition from caregiver to caring giver changed me forever. And just as Bob Horner taught me the importance of being physically connected to my patients, so did Nellie teach me the essential for being emotionally connected, the difficulty of which cannot be overstated, for it requires personal vulnerability and a willingness to be psychologically and spiritually invested. A weakness seen by some, but a strength to all of those who so desperately need to see our humanness. I'll forever be grateful to Nellie for helping me appreciate the importance of this most important dimension and for furthering my evolution of I'm the Doctor. Now, shortly after my return to Boston University from fellowship in critical care in Miami, another event occurred, one that's so complex and unique, I'm sure you will agree, I still marvel at it. I'd assumed responsibility for the Department of Surgical Critical Care Services, and soon after that, I met a Mr. Scaramanga, whose permission I have to tell the story today, and whose son, while attending a local college, developed headache and was operated on for glioblastoma. And despite doing well initially, he suffered a massive postoperative intracranial hemorrhage and was rendered in a vegetative coma. And every morning thereafter at 5 a.m. for the entire next month, Mr. Scaramanga and I would meet in the family waiting room and discuss the events of the previous evening and review the plan of the upcoming day. And he was a gentle, soft-spoken, diminutive man who was unwilling to accept that anything other than a good outcome would ever be possible. And we became genuinely emotionally connected and shared many stories of the Isle of Idra, an idyllic island off the coast of Greece, where I spent a month on vacation in 1967 in what he called home. His love and utter devotion to his son left an indelible impression upon me, one that I ultimately understood when I ultimately had two sons of my own. But time passed without improvement, and those of us know the typical progression of these cases, his son was in the end transferred to a nursing home. Our daily meetings came to a close, and I was redirected to tend to all of the other patients in our intensive care unit. What happened next was an event that once again provided further clarity to my evolving definition. I was awakened by my beeper at 2 a.m. in the early morning of July 1st, 1986. I dialed a number, and the voice at the other end of the phone indicated I had dialed a funeral home. Of course, I apologized for dialing the wrong number. But I was asked if I was Dr. Yeston and was told that a Mr. Scaramanga was calling and hoped that I would speak with him. He took the phone and spoke slowly, formally, and almost dispassionately so that he could be clearly understood. "Dr. Yeston," he said, "it seems my son has died. It occurred at 9 o'clock this morning. But his body is still warm to the touch, and I cannot allow the mortician to proceed with the embalming until I am sure that he has died. Will you help me?" For just a minute, I thought that this was a dream, but it wasn't, and I got into my car and I drove to a distraught father. Now, I never could have imagined that my job, my profession, my career, my calling would ever lead me to an embalming room, but there I was, and as you can imagine, I performed a most complete examination. Sometimes OCD is a real plus. The body indeed was still warm, though having been pronounced dead 17 hours previously when death had actually occurred. It seems that the electrical power had gone out of the nursing home that morning, leaving it without air conditioning, and that plus being wrapped in a plastic shroud and coupled with rising postmortem body temperature, the body stayed warm throughout the day. When I confirmed to my friend that his son had died, he embraced me and thanked me for the comfort that he needed in order to proceed with the burial of his son. But as I drove away, I came to understand and appreciate the magnitude of the responsibility that we all have for caring not only for the patients that we have the privilege to serve, but in many cases, and more often, more importantly, for those loved ones who are in even greater and more desperate need of our care and caring. How ironic, I processed, that in this case, it was my patient for whom I could do absolutely nothing, but his loved one for whom I could do everything. I've received a phone call from my friend every July 1st for the last 27 years. He just turned 90 years of age, and I cannot imagine a greater gift. And there were so many gifts along the way, and just like so many of you, so many lessons learned. But now, as the King of Hearts so wisely advised, we have come to the end. I hope my journey has resonated with some of you, but I especially hope it's resonated with those of you who are about to embark upon your own journey. There are so many lessons ahead, and just like mine, they will come at the most unlikely moments. Recognize them, and then embrace them, and they will enrich your lives beyond measure. And in the end, as it has for me, gives us meaningful understanding to that phrase so naively proclaimed by me 46 years ago, I am a doctor. Thank you.